Hey, everybody. Welcome to Crew Call, Volume 2-8, the August 2020 show. And I'm pleased to be talking with my old buddy and also Ops Crew member, hence the name Crew Call, right? Jim Dufour. Hey, Jim, how you doing, buddy?
Hi, Mike. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, you know what? If you know, I'm trying to persuade basically everybody I know, because if I know you, by definition, you're interesting. I'm trying to persuade everybody to come on, and Jim was gracious enough to come on. He's got a lot to talk about, I think, because Jim has a very fine model railroad that we're going to get into in some detail. But I thought it might be interesting to talk a little bit about how we first met. Now, I don't know how it went with you, Jim, but I got a call from our mutual buddy, Dave.
Yep.
And Dave said in his classic monotone, "You want to go to California for $99?
Yep.
To which I replied, "What?" And apparently another mutual buddy, Wayne Hills, was on hold with the airline. There had been some kind of a advertised mistake, misprint, or whatever you want to call it, that you could go round trip to California at that time for the unheard of price for, I think it was $99.
Yeah, and everybody read newspapers.
Exactly. Remember the newspaper? So I immediately said, sure, and hadn't really done a lot of, I think I'd gone to Canada with Dave and Wayne, but I hadn't really done much travel rail fanning or even really a ton of rail fanning at all. And it all seemed very exciting to me. So fast forward to make a long story short. One of the guys on this trip, and I think it was five of us plus Wayne's dad who disappeared to go do his thing. But five of us, two people I had never met. One of them was Tony La Russa, right?
That's it.
Later went on to be a baseball manager. No, that's a different, different Tony La Russa. But, and this guy, Jim Dufour, who, as it turns out, we liked him.
That was a first.
And Jim was one of these guys who was always looking for elevation, so could usually be found clinging to some cliff face or hillside or perched on a ballast pile or whatever.
The human drone.
Exactly. And you and Dave soon discovered your penchant for fire sign theater, which left the rest of us scratching our heads. But I don't know. For me, it was an epic trip and led to a lot of different things, right? I mean,
led to this.
I mean, well, yes, among other things, and a lot of stuff in between.
A lot of stuff in between. That's right.
Yeah. I mean, what's your fondest memory of that trip? Because mine was everybody being unable to pry me off that rock at the Hatchipee Loop. I was just like riveted there.
Oh, God, there's so many. That's a tough one because there's so many things I could say, but I do remember one thing I remember in regards to you specifically was the last full day we were there, you wanted to go in and rail fan industrial lines around Los Angeles.
Right.
And I wanted to go to LAUPT and shoot passenger trains for a day. So the two of us, we must have teamed up on a rental car, I assume.
Didn't I drop you off or something?
Yes.
And yeah,
at the station. Yeah, I spent the whole day there. And I want to say at the end of that trip, before we flew home, I went down to San Diego to visit my two brothers down
there.
That's
right.
So I want to say that I got on the train at LAUPT and took the train to San Diego and then came back up and you guys picked me up for the.
Did I drop you at Fullerton or something?
You know that.
Well, that might have been Wayne's dad. Anyway,
that was Wayne's dad.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that, Mike. When we went there from LAX to drop Wayne's dad. Now, remember, I'd been to California once, but I hadn't really rail fanned California.
Right. Same with me.
He parked that van. We had to wait a while for his Amtrak to. He was going down to Del Mar, I think, and just north of San Diego, and we parked the van. I don't think we are out of it yet. And a set of war bonnets went through with a stack train.
Right.
Like 60 miles an hour.
Straight through the station. Right, right.
This is after, you know, how many years of Guilford at 10 miles an hour and some Conrail, which
right.
I always loved, but
there didn't look like Kansas nothing. Anymore, Toto, did it?
Exactly. Oh, my God. I thought, oh, this is going to be an interesting trip.
And, you know, experiences like that can really put the hook in you. And some of our friends know that that trip resulted in all of us, to one extent or another, returning to California many times. Now, that first one was like what, 93 or something like that?
Yeah, it was the early 90s, you know, before we, when I agreed to do this, I knew we'd talk about this. And I thought, what year was that? And I don't have my log with me. I have a log book at my condo where I'd be able to tell you exactly right. when it was, but I don't have it with me.
But I remember we were, well, I don't, at the time I didn't realize how fortunate we were, but we yeah. caught, that trip was the only trip that was before the Borg swallowed SP, and so we caught pure, unadulterated Southern Pacific, and it was tremendous. I remember taking like 10 minutes to drive along the length of the yard there in West Colton, which you could see, and this is at highway speed, you know. And then we popped up on Pepper Avenue, where you and I have spent countless happy hours shooting fish in a barrel there. You know, I mean, those really were the days. And it actually resulted in each of us buying some land out in California.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we both had thoughts of retiring out there.
California dreaming, baby.
Yeah. And you know, quite, but... and things change, of course. Yeah, and, yeah. Frankly, California looks a lot less inviting to me now with what's going on out there with the fires and the climate and the lack of the kind of railroad stuff that at the time we took for granted. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm sure it's still awesome in many ways, but it's funny how, you know, things change and you just kind of move on and you develop deep roots and, you know, couple of divorces each for us and a couple of remarryings happily, and here we are, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a lot of time, a lot of water over the dam.
Yeah, it sure is. Sure is.
So when did you start your layout, Jim, or roughly, in relation to what we're talking about?
Yeah, that would have been March of 2005. I bought that condo and
moved
in, and that was the first thing I did was get started.
Right, right, so
15 years, hard to believe.
And when you started your layout, you know, your layout always hits me as an extremely well planned out in advance layout, you know. Well, I remember those drawings that you showed me with, even before you expanded into the other section, I remember looking at that, you know, like the peninsula drawing, you know, the one that kind of looped around there. There's a pole, I think, in the middle, right? Or something like that?
Yeah, where the peninsula was, there's only one. So, yeah. That's behind that bullnose is a lally column.
Right, right, right. And I remember looking at that drawing and you know, bear in mind, I was just, you know, stone knives and bones, you know, at the time in terms of building a model railroad. You know, if you'd seen the chicken scratches that I had on a piece of paper that I started my first layout with, I looked at yours and it was just like, oh man, this is next level stuff, you know.
Oh, about that, Mike. But...
compared to what I was doing, it was, you know. Remember, I learned a lot from all of you guys, you know. Everybody in our little peer group was years ahead of me, you know, in terms of building the layout, skill set, everything. You know, we a lot of cross-pollination too, right? So we all kind of learn stuff from each other as well. So when you started your layout, what was the process in going from, you know, blank slate to, hey, here's what I want to do? You know, it's a very specific time frame, very specific era. Talk a little bit about what went into that.
Well, by the time I got there in 2005, I knew what I wanted to model, which was a portion. Obviously, you can't model a whole branch. The Cheshire Branch, the B&M Cheshire Branch, is about 55 miles long. So, like all of us, you you look at the floor space you have, you figure out what might work and what definitely won't work, and you go from there. So by the time I moved in, I knew what I wanted to do, but I didn't know specifically which towns along the line would fit and work. So that was the task at hand, was to start drawing track. If you think about it, my basement, it's only 18 by 28 plus furnace, hot water heater. There isn't much room there. So,
but it's a very intelligent use of the space. Like, the layout seems bigger than the space actually is.
Yeah, and I guess that's because it's crammed in there. What I was going to say was, there's only so many places you can put track and make it work and then have room for anybody to walk down the stairs.
Sure.
and look at the railroad.
Right.
So it kind of designed itself. So if you think about it, it just goes around the walls and there's one peninsula, and it was really impossible to do much more than that and do the Cheshire Branch.
And yet, to describe it like that and then compare it with what you actually see when you go down there, that's the artistry of it for me.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, thanks.
But I guess the question that remains unanswered, even for me, is how did you get interested in the Cheshire Branch?
Well, it's pretty much the arc of my life. I grew up in Nashua, New Hampshire, which was a B&M mainline city. The New Hampshire division didn't go through downtown. In fact, it was on the opposite end of the town from me, which was one of the problems as a kid. I could hear the trains, but I hardly ever saw them.
Right.
You know, I'd be lying awake at night and hear BJ1 grinding up through Nashua, and the horns are all, if you've ever been to Nashua, it's like one big, long, continuous S-curve.
Okay.
With a lot of road crossing. So at night, you could hear the trains working their way through town.
Wow.
But I didn't.
When you got old enough to ride your bike, that probably helped.
Yeah, a little bit. But it wasn't the same as guys, like Wayne and guys who grew up in a rail fan family.
Sure.
It's like, what are we doing this weekend? Well, let's go rail fan. I didn't have that. So I was a late starter compared to a lot of guys. But the hook got set on the B&M when I was a kid. And I should mention that across the street was an engineer named Eddie Moquin. This guy was a railroad man through and through, and he set the hook more than anybody.
Ah.
Just by being there. You know, he'd come over and he knew I was a young kid that was interested in model trains, and
he knew he had a live one.
Yeah. And he had two daughters, so he didn't have a son that he could. In fact, my first cab ride was on the Hillsborough local out of Nashua in, that was eighth grade, 1966.
Was it an RS2 or something like that?
SW1.
SW1, wow.
Yeah, they kept three SW1s in Nashua because of the main reason, Mike, was in order to go up the Hillsborough branch, you had to go over a spindly mogul-era trestle.
Oh, wow.
Up in, I want to say it was in South Lyneboro on the way to Bennington and Hillsborough.
So weight restriction.
So exactly. So they always had three of those in the yard. And until the state rebuilt that bridge around the time Guilford took over, then they could run Jeeps up there. It was always SW1s. But what I was going to say was, Eddie said, you want to go for a ride? I'll get you a ride. You know, so he arranged to get me a cab ride on the Hillsborough local one day.
Oh, it wasn't with him.
No, Portland Terminal, or Terminal Portland Division guy, I should say.
Okay.
So he worked out of Boston, Lawrence, places like that. I did ride with him in 1981. I finally had a ride with him on the Haverhill Switcher, which that was a memorable trip too. But anyway, having Eddie across the street, that was the push I needed, or not the push, but the, like I said, that set the hook on my love of the B&M. So
how old were you on the first cab ride, Jim?
That was, how old are you in eighth grade? Like 14, 13?
Okay, early teens. Yeah.
14.
Yeah. If that doesn't put the hook in you, boy, I don't know what would. I mean, I often wonder how my interest in trains would have been had my dad not had an interest in trains, and, you know, we used to go down to New Bedford Yard after dropping my mother off at a part-time job, and we would watch the New Haven freight go out, you know, 2-3 times a week. Yeah. And, you know, that was a memorable experience for me because it was always during that sweet light time of day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like maybe around 6 p.m. So in the summertime, boy, you know, or the fall, it was just, it was gorgeous. And it was Jeep 9s and C-425s and U-25Bs. And it was the New Haven to Penn Central transition. And I started modeling the PC as a teenager.
See, I had none of that when I was a kid. I had nobody to, excuse me, take me down to the yard.
Right.
And it was, you know, after dinner, let's get out and see what's going on in the yard. I didn't have that. So.
Interesting. So so the Cheshire branch was selected from books you read or pictures you had seen, or did you actually tromp around on the carcass of it?
I went to college in Keene, which is
okay,
right in the middle of the Cheshire branch. But even before then, I knew about it a little bit. I don't know how, to be honest with you, because like I said, I was alone. I was a castaway on an island. I didn't know there were such things as even rail fans, let alone historical society magazines, books. So anyway, I went to school in Keene, and then stuck around there for a number of years. I think I was up there for about 6 years, and it was the end of the branch, frankly. But it was enough of I had enough of an interest in what was going on in downtown Keene to get interested in the history of the line through there.
Ah.
So when the time came, all those years later, and I looked at the layout, and you've been in my basement. You can't build the double track Fitchburg division
right
in my basement. You know, I needed something that fit the space, and
yep,
that was a good choice. And
that's interesting. So, had you gone to school in a different place, you might have modeled something entirely different.
Maybe, but yeah, it's, I don't know. At an early age, though, I just decided I really found something attractive about that branch.
Right.
Because it's a branch and it was single track, but it was busy. If you go back to the era that I model, which is 47 to 48, they were running on a typical weekday. You had 6 passenger trains going up outbound from Boston. You had 5 coming back, and then the power from the 6th passenger train was used on the milk train during the night because that needed steam heat, passenger power.
And would the passenger cars from it deadhead back on the milk train too?
No. Typically, there was just a rider combine on the rear of that. I think they just filled out other trains with it. 2 trains went off onto the Rutland at Bellows Falls, and then they went off to Montreal. So they went up and back to Montreal.
Wow.
So it was a busy line, and then you had a local freight in each direction. And then the era that I model was right at the end of the overnight freight came out of Boston every night and went up to Bellows Falls. There was one up and one down every night. And so it was a busy line.
So you had an opportunity to get that branch liney kind of a feel with enough traffic to enjoy operating it. And of course, I've been to several op sessions at your house. I think the miracle of your layout is what you do with your staging yard. It might be the smallest staging yard I've ever seen for a layout that busy. It's incredible. I don't even know how you do it, to be honest with you.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because the last operating session I had, it's probably the last one I'll have trying to do that much because of a lot of things. Small,
right,
small staging yard, small run. The main line's less than 100 feet. So I just decided, and I know you guys have been talking a lot about this, how best to, what's the word I'm looking for? Just evolve an operating plan.
Sure.
From where you think you want to start, where you do start, because you think that's the way to do it. But like everything, you have to be open to the idea of changing as you go to make it better. And one of the things I realized was I'm just trying to do too much, too many guys, too many trains.
Right.
So if and when I ever get going again with operating sessions, I think it'll be a lot more scaled down.
Slower pace. So, I mean, the problem is in your era, you had, it was timetable operation and those trains kind of moved, didn't they?
Passenger trains were on a schedule. You're right.
Right. Yeah. Right.
So what I'm thinking is, I think most people are like me, their favorite thing you love to do is just take a local freight and switch some industries. There isn't a lot, but there's enough. So I think if you pick the middle of the day and I picked one or two passenger trains in the late morning, and then the two local freights when there's not much traffic, passenger traffic in the middle of the day, and then maybe one or two passenger trains in the early afternoon, mid-afternoon, that's it. And you could keep people busier, I think, rather than having them up in the kitchen.
Exactly, in the crew lounge.
And, yeah. Yeah. So
and would you end the day with your milk train, maybe?
Yeah, maybe, just for, yeah. Yeah, skip ahead to, I think it got out of Bellows Falls around 11 o'clock at night, but yeah, something like that. We'll see. We'll see where it goes.
Yeah. It is interesting. You know, Confalona and I did that ops challenge for about a month there, and geez, I learned a lot from it. And of course, I've been very busy since then. We'll talk about that later. But I'm itching to get back to it. Maybe as soon as September. Mm-hmm. You know, like ops on everybody's layout, I think are different. You know, I go up to Confalon's or go to Neil Schofield's or Jim Reddington's or your house, and every layout is, I think, very different. Although what I see is a uniform commitment to doing it right. You know, the layouts all look good and they operate well, and they're a pleasure to run on, you know. So when you decided to model the Cheshire branch, how did you zero in on what you actually see when you go to your layout?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. What happened was, before I even owned that condo, and here's a little sidebar, Mike, based off of what we were talking about a few minutes ago. My original track plan was for the basement of the house that Steve Stringer designed for me on Tehachapi Pass. Remember that?
Oh, yes. I forgot all about that.
So I was going to, what I was going to do in that basement was start at North Walpole, because you had a little yard, the Fitchburg Yard up there. You had an engine terminal with a sand house and a coaling tower and all that stuff.
That was what, twice the amount of space at least?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. And it had a garage that, I told Steve, I said, you can design the garage in there, but
but I'll never park in it.
Yeah. So when I, you know, when that dream died, and I realized, well, I'm going to be hanging around New England perhaps for the rest of my life, that's when I went looking for another place to live. I was living in a little studio apartment, biding my time to move out to California.
Right.
So I looked for something with a decent basement, which was the best I could afford at the time. And so there was going to be, I'm building the buildings. I knew I wanted to do Troy because that was just a neat town to begin with. And a lot of the original buildings are still there. At least they were at that time. I could go up, measure them, draw them up and build, scratch build them. So I was building the buildings and the details, and I still had my heart set on North Walpole. I had Rich Cobb built me the coaling tower and the sand house, and I was starting to figure out how to do the engine terminal. And then I bought that condo, and then, you know, as you know, you start putting everything on a piece of paper in front of you to scale, and I realized it's not going to work. The only
thing
that
can
work, you can't do it all, exactly. So then I started thinking in terms of, well, what towns on either side of Troy would I be interested in doing? The short version of the long story is that I thought the best thing to do would just be to take the five consecutive stations that I picked, because they all had something interesting about them, and just do that what I call a slice.
Okay. So rather than pick and choose things, you yeah. chose to have the segment that you modeled be yeah. contiguous.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what, for operating sessions, that works pretty good because you can just take a slice of the employee timetable and the times are almost the same.
Well, on my last Kaboom, when I finally got it right, it was only at that point that it made sense to me, to be honest with you. You know, I don't know if you remember early obsessions here, but it was always like, where am I? Which direction am I going? Where's my train going to pop out of? You know what I mean? Getting rid of all of that helped a great deal.
It does. Yeah. And I remember those early op sessions. I do. A lot of things at my age I forget, but I remember.
Well, I still remember my visit from the Static Grass Masters. I was whining about how I just couldn't get any results doing Static Grass. Yeah. And you and Neil and Confalone came down and did like, you know, massive areas on my layout with Static Grass. And it was like a teaching thing I remember it just being a very high impact visit. And how much time and grass would I have wasted trying to figure that out on my own? You know, I mean, that's the kind of thing that we do,
these relationships. I know if you look at Neil Schofield, myself, and Randy LaFramboise up in Vermont, we would exchange ideas on the static grass and also the super trees.
Really?
Yeah. Like we'd get together. Maybe I went up to Randy's and I showed him the long drawn out way to do super trees with the matte medium and the clothesline and all that stuff. And he came back down one weekend to visit me and said, all you need is Aquanet. So we did a tree session outside my condo.
Oh, you don't even dip them now?
No.
Interesting.
Just paint them and spray. I call it paint and spray, you know, or whatever. And I couldn't believe how fast it went.
That's interesting.
So it's same thing with the static grass, just getting together, explaining to each other what you've learned since the last time.
Right.
Sharing those ideas.
Sharing techniques.
That community of making each other better is just one of my favorite things about this hobby we share is, because what do they say? A rising tide lifts all boats.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like
we're all in this together, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And it's that to me is one of the best parts of the hobby.
Well, you know, the picture that I used, I put two pictures on the podcast group as teasers for this show, and one of them is you at your layout, and the other one is me with the menacing screw gun there, which is a classic picture.
I had another one of you like doing a ta-da, pointing to the finished rock on the wall, but it had camera movement in it.
Oh, it was a little blurry. Yeah,
yeah, it's a funny shot of you, but
maybe you can just tell people what I'm talking about there in your own words. What went on that day?
Again, we're talking about community, and when I decided it was time to, for people that don't know, I built my layout in two phases, and I go into this in my
clinic.
My layout RPM clinic, you know, where I explain that I built the first half on one half of the basement just to get things going. And then I had a little shelf around the wall on the other side just so trains could run continuously. Because that was one of the best pieces of advice I got from, I believe it was Mike Sparks.
Get them running.
Get them running. And get them so they run around the room so you can have a open house or whatever. And so it came time to start in on the other half of the room. And in fact, Randy LaFramboise offered to come down and help me. And he was he works construction. So he had the holidays off between Christmas and New Year's. We're talking 2009, I think.
Okay.
So, he says, I'm coming. And if you know Randy, he's coming. You better be ready. So I'm thinking,
He's a force.
He really is unbelievable. Well, he's like you in a way. Same thing, because I called you up. I think you must have mentioned that you would be willing to come down. I know you had a good sized van at that time. You could fit sheetrock in. And you came up. I think you had the gun, which I didn't have. I didn't have anything. And
we went over to Home Depot,
loaded that thing up with sheetrock, and came back and went to town.
We basically did that other side of your basement, right?
We did, yeah. And mud too. And I think you left and of course you got to go back and put a second coat of mud, but you not only hung the rock, but you did the mudding. So yeah, it was a very productive day.
Well, it kind of kicked off that second side of the basement there. Yeah, I think that might have been the last thing that I did there, Jim, you know.
It's all right. You've been busy.
I have been a little busy, but you know, I do specialize at times with the high impact visit, you know, just to kind of get somebody over a hump or to catalyze something into activity. And it's been the same thing, you know, been the same thing with other friends here. So, you know, you know, in this whole we're all in this together thing, you know, Jim heard that I was in need of cinders.
Oh yeah.
And found a way to get them to me via, it was Neil, right? That you gave them to Neil, and Neil got them to me. Shows up with a half a Home Depot bucket full of cinders, and Jim made the mistake of saying, you know, just use what you need and give me whatever you don't use. And I kind of looked at Pittston Yard and Taylor Yard, and I thought, yeah, you're not seeing this bucket.
Now, in all honesty, Mike, if I was to take the lid off that bucket right now, what would I see?
Less.
Well, yeah.
A lot less.
That's a given.
Actually, I honestly don't remember. The last time I was using it was when I was doing a Voca yard. And boy, did it just look right there. I'm telling you that, you know, for my modeling area, that is the stuff you need, you know. Yeah. I mean, my hope is that sometime this winter, I'm going to get to ballasting either Taylor or a Pittston yard, which would be a little more daunting because it's friggin' gigantic. But, you know, I really don't have anything scenic in the new room at all, except for that little area around the viaduct at Diriyah. So I've been focused on trying to finish up things in the old train room. So, you know, just having that stuff there. I mean, I wish we could get another 5-gallon pail of it.
It's yours. Well, first of all, feel free to use as much as you want, because I knew this might happen. So to be honest with you, I skimmed about a gallon off the top of that.
Oh, good.
And I'm going to, because you know how big my layout is. Plus, it's pretty much scenic in terms of cinders. It's not to say I still don't use them occasionally.
Yep.
I have enough for probably what I'll need. So, and as far as getting more, assuming that the little mine of it, by the way, those are certified Boston and Albany cinders.
Right.
I'm not going to name the town. This is our little mine, but
absolutely,
Neil knows where it is.
Right.
So, with any luck, there's still some there, and we can go get more.
It's possible I have enough, but I'm telling you, when you start doing a yard, especially a 22-foot long yard, I can't imagine that there's enough there to do that and Taylor. You know what I mean? I'm wrong about that. You know, but you do have to screen it again. You know what I mean? So you don't get 100% use of it. So I just don't have a good feel for how far it's going to go. You know, and I find with ballast, you always use more than you think. Have you found that?
Yeah. Yep.
Any kind of ground cover, you know.
Especially true. I don't know about you, but I end up, the final sift is through one of those skillet, what do they call them? It's like a spatter shield you put over the top.
Oh, boy, so you go really fine.
It's like, I have found in HO anyway, the finer, you want almost a powder. And for some reason or other, that to me looks better than something with more rocks in it. Now, something like cinders in a yard, it might be, you can get away with something a little more coarse.
But right. I think you said you did didn't you do like a window screen when you were filling the bucket?
Yeah, it was in the back. I had the bucket. And what I scoop it with is, it's kind of a, in fact, I just saw it yesterday. I was up at the condo. It's, it looks like a little bucket that's actually a sieve.
Okay.
And I don't know the grades of sieve, you know, whatever they're called, but it allows the coarse stuff through, but the big hunks, I just toss them back on the ground.
Right.
I use
right.
that to scoop the cinders out of the ground. I do the same thing with dirt.
Yes, I do the same thing with dirt too. So what? Yeah. So my secondary screening, I got a big, I don't know, maybe like what you'd use to rinse vegetables or fruits or something. You know, I wanted, I was doing it with this little thing. It was just taking me forever. So I went down to the store and got one like, you know, 10 inches in diameter, a big dome. And yeah, just dump it in there and just kind of rub it. And I don't throw away the stuff that I screen out because I figure it'll be useful for rubble here and there. You know what I mean? Like almost everything has some use.
Yeah, even when I get down to that fine sieve, the stuff that remains on top, I save that so that I just did this at State Line when I redid State Line is the first course of cinders when you just got track sitting on the sub roadbed. I don't put the fine stuff there.
Right.
Typically, I don't. It depends, but
that'll be a top coat, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. That makes sense. In fact, that's what I've done with some of my conrail ballast. You know, if I, you know, sometimes you have species in the cork or something, you just want to fill it up with something. I use that really cork stuff. I mean, the really coarse stuff, then I do a top coat over it with more scale size stuff.
Yeah, I've always got those big gaping gaps in the plywood and everything. I just fill all that in with the rocks. And
right. Sometimes you keep filling it in and you realize, where's this going? And then you look, you get a little pyramid on the floor underneath.
I know it.
Shouldn't take that much.
Yeah, this is taking more than I expected. Where's it going?
So you had mentioned Rich Cobb. And, you know, we've all had the benefit of his efforts on our layouts. I think that, I know in my case, there's buildings I never would have gotten around to building that, had it not been for Rich, it just wouldn't look like that. He's built all of the private homes that I have. I just have no interest in building a house. I don't know why. I just zero. So that's been a big boon. And he's done a couple of other, you know, non-home things for me in Laceyville. You have a sort of a mix, right? Like you've built maybe half your buildings and he's built the other half. Would you say that's accurate or not so?
I'm going to say he's more like a 25 or 30%.
Okay, so
like
you've
that.
Built more than, yeah. You, yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And it, would you, did you use him to get yourself going in the earlier days and now you're just doing it all yourself, or was it certain kinds of things you farmed out to him?
I guess I'd say that it was more, I used him in the beginning. Like I said, he ended up, I used Rich to do the coaling tower and sanding tower at North Walpole, buildings I never used. I still have them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You just ended up, not modeling those areas?
I didn't model North Walpole. I couldn't fit it on my
layout.
Oh, wow.
So when you ordered those, were you thinking the California basement?
Yeah.
Ah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And even then, I was looking for a home. I was pretty sure if I wanted to live that close to Boston, I couldn't afford a house, per
right.
se. And I wanted something new. I didn't want to deal with leaky basements and all that stuff.
Oh, right, right.
So in order to buy something I could afford, I wound up in a condo, but that's fine. The room, I got
it's a lovely town and you've got a little railroad line right near it.
Yep.
That's still in use?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
We'll see what happens if they sell Pan Am, if they get sold and what happens. I get a feeling if that happens, there'll be some shifts in the paradigm, if you will. But we'll see. We'll see what happens.
Well, let's get back to your layout because I think that's what people are going to want to hear about. And I'm going to be posting those nice pictures you sent me on the group. If you're starting out in staging, maybe you could just kind of walk us through where you're going and how you end up back at staging.
Yeah. So, like I said, we're going to go around the room with one peninsula. So if we go, let's say we'll go westbound. Out of staging.
Is that clockwise?
That is counterclockwise as you're looking at the wall. So west is to your left.
Okay.
and that stays the same all the way around the room.
So you go by the bulkhead never to be used.
That's right. Just don't tell the fire marshal. But you come through the wall because the staging, if you remember, Mike, there's a landing at the bottom of the stairs where they turn 90 degrees. Well, that's taken up with the staging. So you basically go through the wall on your left and right out onto State Line, which was actually located at the state line between Winchendon, Massachusetts and Fitzwilliam, New Hampshire.
Okay.
So hence the name. So you did, that was just, it was more of a post office than a station there, but there were, I think, two trains a day would stop on Flag to pick up people.
Yep.
But you go out onto the, in front of the bulkhead, out onto the causeway. And then the next town, you go around the corner. Now you're facing the next wall in the basement.
Yep.
And that's Fitzwilliam.
Okay.
Which was the next town up the line.
That's got a nice, is that the one that has a nice elevator there?
It has the grain elevator, yeah.
Yeah, you built that, right?
Yes, I did, yeah.
Yeah, that's a beauty.
Yeah, I'm supposed to be writing an article for our friend at MRH there. But we'll see. I promised him at Springfield earlier this year I'd write an article for him, but I haven't done it yet. Anyway, then you go around the wall again. Now you're facing the back wall of the basement. That's Troy, which Troy, I like. My goal was to have at least one town that was pretty much the track layout as it existed and pretty much to scale in linear feet, scale feet. And if I had another 12 or 18 inches, that town would be to scale.
Exact. Wow. So maybe that's partly, I guess, why it just looks so anatomically correct to me. You know, you look at that and everything's in the right proportions, and
that's,
you know, the slight compression you did. I mean, I'd never notice it. That's for sure. You know, I mean, I think it's clever the way you took, like, your layout is not overcrowded. So you have like one scene per wall, you know what I mean? With enough connective tissue in between that's beautiful to run through, that you feel like you're going somewhere.
Yeah, when you're really not going very far, the idea, it's all illusion, right? It's all
right.
Suspended disbelief.
A little sleight of hand.
Yeah, yeah. So when you leave Troy, you're going west.
Well, wait a minute. Well, now, what's in Troy? I mean, maybe you can describe what you do when you're there.
Yeah, well,
there's an oil dealer, right?
No, yes, I'm sorry, there was. It started off as a coal dealer. There were actually two coal dealers there, one on each side of the tracks. There's a, as with all the stations I modeled, there's a passing siding, there's a depot. But there's also another siding, a double-ended siding parallel to the passing siding. And that had the freight house and the oil dealer you just mentioned, which started off as a coal dealer, I would assume. And then they probably, I'm going to guess in the 30s, but I don't know this for a fact. By the time you get to the era that I'm modeling, there were two oil tanks there. So I modeled those. And then on the other side of the main line was the depot and a loop, a kind of a track that looped away from the main line. And so it creates like this big parking lot between the main line and this siding, this spur. And that spur was used mainly for, you know, they'd park 40-foot boxcars there. And what are they called?
Team track.
Team, thank you. And I believe that a lot of the business on that track went down the hill to Troy Mills.
Back.
And then at the end of that spur was a little portable coal conveyor. And there's almost always a hopper sitting there, usually an anthracite hopper, usually a Redding one. The few pictures I've been able to see what kind of hopper it is, it's a Redding hopper. So I modeled that. And there was a along the back of the platform.
So wait a minute, that hopper would be like local delivery for trucks?
Yeah, yeah. I have a beautiful picture. It was taken by George Hill, who was the B&M photographer. He rode the line at one point in the, I think it was say 51. And there it is. You can see a hopper. You can see the conveyor coming out from underneath it. And there's a truck there, a little coal delivery truck sitting next to it. Perfect. You know, just a perfect little scene that you, you could do. And
it's like another consignee that doesn't take much.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. And then I forgot there was a siding that ran along the platform up to the station. And I think that was usually LCL. They might have had an LCL car they dropped there. And again, it faced that, quote, parking lot. So you could use it as a team track as well.
Yep.
So all those tracks are modeled. So when you switch there, you got the same switching problems that any crew on the XW1 and WX2 would have had.
And you're keeping an eye on the timetable because passenger trains can, be in the way.
they can interrupt your...
You'd better clear up.
Yep. So.
So if you continued after Troy.
Uh-huh. Now you get out onto the peninsula. You leave, the benchwork and go out on the peninsula, which that was Randy LaFramboise's creation. Because I was just going to skirt the furnace and get right back against the wall again. And he insisted on putting that peninsula in. I wasn't convinced it could fit without pinch points in the aisle or an 18-inch radius curve on the end of it. But he said, I had sketched it out on paper and I thought it could work, maybe, depending on how you rotated it. And he said, draw it out on the floor.
Right.
When I come down, we'll look at it. So I drew the fascia and then what I hoped would be the center line of the track on the floor.
Just use chalk or something?
Yep. And he came down and he looked at it and he had brought his work pickup, which is, it's like your van, it's like
right.
Whatever you want to carry, I can carry it. So he said, okay, let's go. Where's the Home Depot? We took off. He came down, I think, for 3 days, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and we banged out all of that.
Jeez.
And yeah, he did
talk about high impact.
If you know Randy. So that was it. It was no turning back at that point. And I'm so glad he talked me into it because.
Well, it adds so much to the run.
Yeah, there's no, that's the only real wide open run on the layout where there's no buildings. It's all just, they followed the South Branch or the Ashuelot River there. There's a couple neat little bridges. And
how close to prototype is what I see on that peninsula?
Very close, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, as model railroads go, it isn't museum quality or anything. But the important thing is, and the point of the whole thing for me was, you want to be able to let your train go for a bit and watch it. But when you get all the way to the other side of the peninsula, you have the Troy Ledges. And if you're from that part of New Hampshire, even if you're not a railroad fan, at least back when I was in college, you knew what the Troy Ledges were.
I see.
If you were a local.
So it's a real landmark.
Yeah, that was that series of cuts they had where they had gained all the elevation they could, and the only way to get through that gulf, they called it, or a notch, was to just cut granite. They had to just find their way through the granite walls there. So that's what I tried to duplicate.
So one of the major scenic elements in that peninsula, as I recall, is that long river.
Yep.
And here's what I wanted to ask you about. Now, that river is not flat.
Yeah, that's right.
And yet you poured casting resin on it, right?
No.
Oh, you didn't? Okay.
No, let me, there's another story for you.
Yeah.
Because you're right. It goes downhill. And I must have asked everybody, including you and Mike Confalone.
I probably tell you, no, you can't do that. It's going to all end up in a puddle at one end.
There you go. It was like, how do I pour a river that flows downhill without
right.
winding up with a puddle on the floor the next morning? So if you may not know Glenn Glastetter, he's another
I've seen the name many times in your emails.
Yeah, really good model. He's a CNO modeler.
Okay.
And he hangs out a lot with Mike Evans.
Yep.
He's a well-known D&H modeler. Both of them live up Vermont, New York way. And he sent me a list of, if you're trying to do this kind of water, this is the material you want to use.
Huh.
And for flowing water like that, he suggested...
Mud Podge.
No.
No?
He suggested a gloss medium. Golden
okay.
gloss medium. And I'll tell you what, Mike, I bought one of everything before I talked to... As I was talking to everybody, I bought one of everything. When Michaels had their 40% off coupon, I'd go get another 55-gallon drum of Envirotex.
Right.
You know, I just had all this stuff. I still do.
Yep.
So here comes Randy, calls me up one day. He says, you know, I really want to come down and work on your layout. So I said, yeah, come on down. He came down for a weekend, and he looked at that riverbed, which now had been sitting there for like a year.
Right. I remember that.
With nothing in. It was all set to go. It's like,
right.
I just didn't know what to do without, you don't want to screw up 10 feet of riverbed. You know,
exactly.
You got to get it right. And he said, well, what do you got? And I said, oh, I got Envirotex. I got this golden gloss medium. And I think I had one other one, Magic Water or something. And
oh, the Woodland Scenics product?
Maybe. I'm not. I don't know.
We've all tried all of that stuff.
I had them all.
I found their
you.
Stuff to be soft, like physically soft,
yeah.
so that you know you could actually dent it.
I used
even
stuff
after it was cured.
At Troy, I had that little river that goes on the through the double box culvert.
Yeah.
The road by the fascia, same thing.
Yep.
I decided I'd look for something else.
Sure.
But anyway, he when he comes down, it's like you just, like when you have guys come over to work on your layout, you try to have a list.
Yep.
So I told him what I had, and then I walked around the corner because I thought he'd want to follow me and I'd show him a couple potential projects to work. You know where this is going.
Oh, yeah.
I come back around the corner and he's pouring this stuff into the riverbed. He's just going at it. He had a brush and, oh my God, it came out beautiful. I mean.
So this is the gloss medium that you use, this particular gloss medium.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It kind of stays where you put it. It looks like milk when you pour it. It's like
okay.
this milky, but it's very viscous.
Must have had your heart in your mouth when you saw that.
I said, what's he doing? But, it came out beautiful. I don't know if he had used it once and he knew that was the right choice.
Or yeah.
He just, knowing Randy, he just went for it.
Wow.
And I had to go back and touch up a couple places because, it's at an angle. It's on a grade, but there are places where it kind of levels off and then
sure.
goes down again. And to make it look believable, I had to go back and fill in some places along the shore and so forth. But in the end, I thought it came out pretty good.
Outstanding. So here's where we get to talk about lessons learned. I know that you've done a little bit of rebuilding there.
Oof.
We could benefit probably from, yeah. I don't know, I always talk about Mike's big mistake. So we know what you did right. The layout is freaking gorgeous, as the pictures will attest. But you've had to do a little bit of redos in certain infrastructure standpoints. So maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, it's painful, but I'll talk about it.
Yeah, no, listen. Who doesn't make mistakes?
Yeah, my big mistake, and I repeated it in a different way, was not to have well-engineered track. And
but you thought it was well engineered when you did it, Mike.
I asked you. I asked hundreds, dozens of guys before I did anything. I don't think I had even moved in yet. I started asking people, "What did you use for this? What did you use for that?" And I asked a few people, "What did you use for your roadbed?" And the first time around,
sub roadbed, you mean?
Sub roadbed. Well,
right.
Yeah. Well, in my case, the roadbed, I used the wrong one, let's say. I don't know if I should name names, but...
Sure you can.
Well, I guess the first half of my layout, I used that, I think it's AMI It's like a black construction material, very sticky and gooey.
Oh yeah.
And the trouble is, it holds your track pretty good at first, but if you want to move anything, not so much.
Right.
And then over time, it tends to want to move even more. So without going into a long rant, I just wouldn't recommend it. In fact, I don't think it's even available anymore. I don't know. So when I went to do the second half of the layout.
But wait a minute, what was under it, Jim?
Plywood.
Okay. So it was this. Yep. Okay.
This stuff was like a little bit wider than your track.
Yes.
So the concept was it lifts your track up off the plywood so you can have
ballast shoulders.
Yes.
Gotcha. And,
but it just, it wasn't, I'm sure I could talk to, you could talk to guys who will tell you, I used it. I love it. In fact, the guy who's now passed on who used it on his whole layout, he swore by it, but he knew something I didn't figure out.
All right. And we'll compare notes when you're done with phase two here, but go ahead.
Yeah. So phase two arrives and I'm like thinking, I got to do something different here. And unfortunately, I hadn't met Ted Shasta yet, who unlocked all the secrets. And I've watched him relay enough portions of my layout to know how one should do track. But anyway, I went to my local hobby shop. I said, I don't want to use that stuff. What do you recommend? And he had a back room full of Woodland Scenics foam roadbed.
Right.
And he convinced me that this was the greatest stuff since sliced bread. So I bought
probably the key there is he had a back room full of
it. Yeah, it's what he sells, right? I can get it from Walther's in a hurry up. So I did the whole second half of my layout with that stuff with pretty much the same result. Disappointment at the fact. Now, to be fair, I screwed up because I didn't use what most people would probably consider the proper adhesive to anchor that to the plywood and then anchor your track to it. But when I put that track in, all my easements looked beautiful. The radius on the curves was beautiful. The track vertically was flat. Everything was, it looked great. And I even ran trains over it. And
sure.
They ran great.
I think I remembered running trains on it and it was like, great.
What happened, Mike, was when I went to do the ballast, what do you do with ballast? You soak it with wet glue. At least that's what I soak it
sure.
in.
Sure. Put it what down, mixed it with alcohol, and then I used diluted.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what happens with water-based glue when you soak it in water? It comes loose. I went down there and my track looked like, you know, sun kinks everywhere. I'm like,
oh my God. So what did you put the track down with?
Oh, it must have been Elmer's glue, I guess. It wasn't like an industrial strength adhesive that would
yikes.
Stay. Yeah. So I take the hit for that, but the bottom line is it just created all kinds of locations where trains wanted to derail certain cars, you know, the whole
can't really spike into that stuff. It wouldn't hold.
Yeah, exactly. It's
fine. Oh man.
So anyway, you know, I don't, I've told that story so many times, you know, I feel like.
So you basically went in and ripped all of that out, got back down to the plywood. And then what did you do?
The sections that we redid, during the interim between then and now, I met Ted Shasta. This guy, if you've been to an RPM, you've been to any RPM, he's there most years talking about how to properly do track. And
I've been to his house.
Oh, yeah.
It's a little overwhelming.
Yeah. So he's the guy that saved my behind. You know, he came over and he's been over like four times now. I lose track and said, okay, what's your worst problem area? And I'll say, here. Okay. He'll say, rip it all out and I'll come back next weekend when you're done, or next week, and we'll get started. And he yep. comes back and he applies the Ted Shasta method to those areas, and those are the areas that are virtually flawless.
So how would you describe the Ted Shasta method?
I would say,
is he putting new subroad? Is it new plywood that he's putting in?
Yeah, he gets everything level. He holds up. He looked at it, and after I rip out everything, he says, "How far down can we go until we're anchored to something that won't move?"
Bedrock.
Yeah, and he starts from there. He goes all the way down to the wherever he needs to go, and he works up from there. And the track itself, in most cases, winds up on milled basswood.
Oh, for crying out loud. Yeah.
The track gets spiked into that. It'll never move.
Right.
And if you've ever watched him work, he has this method he uses, and he uses a lot of CA adhesive.
Once to tack things in place?
To put it where it has to go.
I see.
But he also has this interesting method. He drills individual holes in every tie where it needs to be, where they need to keep it from, like on curves.
Sure.
And places where it needs to be anchored and won't move horizontally. He'll drill a hole in every tie just smaller than an HO spike. And he snips the head off the spike and he drives it into that hole and he challenges you to find the spike. You can't see it because he snips the head off and he drives it down flush with the top of the tie, never to be seen again.
Jeez.
Unbelievable. And every section of my layout that he's come back and fixed the track is just, you know.
He does this on every tie on a curve?
Every tie that he can't, if he thinks he can't see, I want to say he does it on every tie, but I want to say also that I've seen him where he just bathes the bottom of he bathes the area between the ties with CA.
Yep.
And then he hits it with the accelerator and boom.
Wow. It'll
be where you want it because you got to tear it all apart if you decide.
The will to do that.
Well, He's not an engineer by trade, but he's an engineer in practice.
In mindset. Wow.
I love watching him work. And it's just a question of getting out of his way and feeding him the stuff he says he needs.
Right.
It's like
right.
A nurse in the OR, you know, needle nose.
now to contrast that, I mean, I'll give you the 4-minute walkthrough of where I started and where I ended up. I remember my very, very first railroad with fiber tie brass flex track.
So do I.
that I was cutting with diagonal cutters and filing the things square until the local hobby shop guy heard me whining about that and sold me a tool that I still use every day, this incredible pair of Lambert box joint flush cutters.
Okay.
They're incredible. I mean, I use them every day. I use them for in my installs. It's how I strip wires. I mean, they're so, because they're box joint, they're made in Japan like in the 70s. You couldn't possibly buy a tool like this now. Doesn't exist.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
I consider it one of my most prized possessions.
Isn't that funny, huh? Those old back of the toolbox.
They don't make them like that anymore, Jim.
They don't, yeah. They don't.
But I gravitated at one point to TruScale track, self-gauging roadbed, you know, tie plates the size of car batteries. But, you know, it was a step up, you know, from what I was using. And then later, when I first started building the current layout, I was using ME flex track on Homa bed and spiking it into that. And I have to say that stuff took spikes really, really well, held them well. And was a nice product, but you know, you really, to do it right, you really had to glue it down. And if you had to make a change, boy, you really had to bring out okay, why am I drawing a blank here? I'm talking about the thing they make holes in pavement with, jackhammer. We're getting
Welcome
up there,
aren't
we?
Mike.
We're getting up there. I'm telling you. Why am I in this room? Oh yeah. So, I knew I came in here for a reason.
I got to walk back out so I can remember.
I've done that.
Oh, me too.
Or sometimes I will stand there with my jaw set thinking, I will remember why I came in here. And often I do.
I don't.
But fast forward, when I adopted a lot of the Confalonian fast track techniques, I threw in the towel and started using cork, which I still don't like very much, but I've liked it better when I started gluing track down with DAP. And that's actually worked well for me because it seems to hold, it lasts through ballasting, no problem. But if I need to get it off for whatever reason, a wide blade putty knife can get it off. So it seems to be the right mix, you know, between holding power and whoops, I got to make a change.
How much time do you have when you put your track down using the DAP? How much time do you have to change your mind?
You've got time. 15 minutes maybe.
Oh yeah, that's good.
The thing I found, the trick to it I found was you want to make sure you're using enough, but you don't want to use too much. Oh, yeah. Because it'll ooze up between the ties, and then you know you're there with a little stick trying to scrape it out. You know, which trust me, once you've done that once, you realize, okay, we're not doing that again. I did have to make a change to my North D&H staging, which I had designed as a single-ended staging yard, and which when I started running myself, realized that was major league dumb. So I ended actually taking a hunk of Pittston Junction out so I could get down to it and use the wide blade putty knife method to lever off about maybe, you know, 14, 16 inches of the end of that so I could curve it underneath the short line and then put another ladder there. One of the best things I ever did. I wasn't sure how that was going to go, but it was actually no problem. It didn't dislodge anything beyond where I was prying it up. So I thought, you know, whew,
that those are moments of white knuckles sometime doing.
Well, had I screwed it up, I mean, I would have had to remove an already in place and working entire Pittston Junction. It would not have been good. Yeah. So it ended up working out okay. But I have to say that the ability, because normally when I'm laying a lot of track, I'll make up 6 foot lengths. I'll solder two sections together, and the Pico track that I've been using and the Pico turnouts have been wonderful to use. It's easy to get a nice smooth flow with it, and if you know you can, you know, you do a maybe a 7 foot length of the cork and put down the track, and you know, I've got some weights that I put on it briefly, but you almost don't need to do that. And you know, you can really go to town putting your track down, whereas if you were spiking this by hand, it'd take you forever, you know. So that's one of the ways I was able to get back up and running as quickly as I did, even while putting down literally hundreds of feet of track.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much track a staging yard takes up, except for yours.
Except for mine. I think Confalone, one of the first times he ever came down, I said, this is my staging yard. That's a fiddle yard. It's not a staging yard. It's a fiddle yard.
Right. And I've seen, I remember one session I was there, and I think Wayne Hills was running it, and he looked like an octopus, just kind of.
There you go. One of the reasons.
He was focused.
One of the reasons I decided not to have such grandiose operating sessions, I don't know if you're at one of the more recent ones, but I had both Wayne and
Dave. No, probably not. I've been a bit of a stay-at-home.
We noticed. Both Wayne and Dave, ex-B&M dispatchers, were dispatching.
Okay.
And they were like, you know, it was a busman's holiday for those two guys. So I had no one to run the staging yard but moi. So I did it. And that's when I realized, God bless Wayne for doing this
all right.
Those last however many operating sessions, because that's when I realized I'm trying to do too much out of this little staging yard here. There were breaks where I had time to get the next train five-fingered into place, but there were other times where it's just trying to do too much. It's
right.
All the fun out of it.
And I think that's part of the whole you know, scale back the speed of things, scale down the number of people, because when you've got a basement full of guys and they're just standing there looking at you, you know, you want to keep them, you want to keep them doing something, and you just kind of become a slave to that, and you don't really enjoy the operating, you know what I mean? So, I mean, don't get me wrong, from the host standpoint, my early obsessions was amazing to see the whole thing come to life and operate as a system and see stuff moving simultaneously that you couldn't possibly do by yourself. I mean, it was amazing. But coming full circle with the solo operations, I know Mike C learned a lot from that, and it's permanently altered how he will do things in the future. He's actually talking, we'll talk about this I think next month or the month after, but he's actually talking about when he's ultimately able to do op sessions again, you know, like 3 or 4 guys and him, period.
Yeah, I could see that.
And sure, that's a giant layout, you know, and I'm thinking the same thing here, you know. So almost by definition, you're going to have maybe 2 different crews. So you can get all your friends in. But I like the idea of continuous running. I like the idea of when it's time for an op session, yeah, you stage a few trains and staging. Beyond that, it just organically goes from where you last operated solo. You know what I mean? And that's very attractive to me, because the idea of taking a day to set up an op session is just not appealing.
No, I agree. Although I do enjoy... Well, I enjoy a couple things about an op session. Number one, it forces me to clean the place, get everything put away, put the curtains up. And again, that community thing, I just love having people I know and trust come over.
Right.
And enjoy ourselves. Yeah, we're enjoying ourselves using the layout, but there's a lot of interesting conversations and just enjoy each other's company.
Sometimes. Yeah, there's the social aspect of it, of course. Yeah, but it's interesting you bring up trust, because you're right. Everybody in our little peer group, and I wouldn't think twice about having them do anything on my layout. We're all like compatible modelers.
Yeah.
So that, you know, so there's that.
No, I want to mention one thing. We jumped past, or not past, but we scurried through talking about the early days on your layout. And I still remember the first time I went down there. I assume it was for an operating session.
Pool table was still there, probably.
Yes, it was.
Yep.
And what struck me the most when I got in there and got a good look at what you were doing and then started running trains was you were modeling Conrail. And Conrail was my favorite railroad, one of my favorite railroads during that period. Certainly my favorite local railroad,
where
I lived so close to Worcester and the Boston line. And I just, same with Neil and CP, which again, one of my all time favorite railroads, the rail fan, those two are at the top of my list. So the joy of going into somebody's layout room and seeing Conrail was
blue.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, there's a lot more of it now, Jim. I've spent the last, my plan was to take May and work on locomotives, you know?
Yeah.
And I discovered that I was a little rusty at first, but it came back fast. And then I discovered that since I had this new model shop and all my parts were upstairs in the bedroom where I used to work on stuff like that when I had no model shop, all the locomotive parts had to come down as I was working on these things.
Yeah.
And then I realized, well, since I've done that, what am I going to do? Go put them all back and then later on take it all out again to work on these other locos. I might as well just keep working on locos. Yeah. And then I kept finding projects that I'd forgotten that I had. And then I started thinking, well, am I going to have the eyesight when I'm 70 to do this? Maybe I should just be finishing up this batch of locomotives now. So you know how that slippery slope goes. So I ended up, I had a group of GP8 and GP10s that I had Brian Benna do some milling for me way before I even had a milling machine. Mm-hmm. And that was 2007. When I looked at the email that was in the shoebox for each loco, because I was getting some, you know, information from people like Scott Chatfield and, you know, guys like that, I said 2007. That's 13 years. So, and of course, since then, Intermountain has brought out GP10s, and you know, the landscape has changed a lot. I think back then, did I have a DC layout back then? Maybe it wasn't even DCC at that time. I don't even remember. But the point being, I had all of these beautiful milled, you know, heavy Atlas Cotto chassis, and like a complete laundry list. I had figured out how to do each one, and they were all different, so that each one had its own personality. You know, one of them had, I think two of them had small fuel tanks that Brian milled off most of the fuel tank, just enough to leave the motor mounted. And one of them has torpedo tubes on the roof, and one of them's a high nose with the dynamics blanked out. You know what I mean? You could just go on and on. So This was the first thing that I tackled, and I was really enjoying the hell out of it. So far I've done 3 out of 5. And then somebody on the list was talking about RS3M conversion hoods. And I said, geez, I've got a bunch of those. And I said, I only need to make one. I'll sell off a couple of these guys who are looking for them. And then I looked at, and I said, you know, I got this old ENSH RS3. Why don't I just do my RS3M? So I built that. And then one of my customers abandoned an old Proto 2000 GP18, which needed a lot of work. And if you recall, that those early P2K units had very, very crude, coarse, like plastic louvers.
Oh yeah.
You know, where the radiators are. I mean, they you know, but the proportions of the shell were good.
You're talking to a steam era guy, Mike.
Oh yeah, okay, but you know, GP18 looks like a GP9, except it's more horsepower.
Like, so louvers and vents and.
So to make a long story short, I ended up completely redoing that, Plano grills and all of this kind of thing. And I did a couple of NW Jeeps, which were prevalent on the DNH in my era. Then I did a couple more NW units.
No,
and
then stopping you now.
Then there's a whole brace of DNH units that I'm working on. It's going to end up being about 17 locomotives. But this is stuff that was, like, I did 4 U-23Bs. Two of them were a Brian Banna disassembled locos that I bought when I bought in his collection, and they were literally down to the smallest part you could disassemble a locomotive into in a Ziploc bag.
In a bag.
Yeah. Each of them. So those were kind of fun to rebuild. I enjoyed it, but it was, you know, a bit of a challenge, you know. And I had two more on decks that I found in drawers, and I said, you know what, I'm just doing this. So now I've got 4 more Conrail U-23Bs and some good local power in those GP10s and the RS3M and the DNA.
So those are locals you finished and they're on the layout?
Yeah.
Layout worthy?
Yep, I'm going to be most of them are weathered. Couple more.
Awesome.
If you were on Faceplant, you'd see the pictures I posted on the group. Did some GP30s that were again on Cato chassis that I had Brian mill for me. I got those done and completed. So
I'm impressed.
You know, the spectrum of the Conrail roster that I wanted to model has gotten a lot more interesting now. You know. And I'm probably going to do that on weekends. We run this local power on road trains thing, which is kind of a fun thing to do, you know? Uh-huh. So, you know, that's kind of what I've been up to, but it's now I'm in month 3 of this project.
Yeah, it's such a good feeling to.
It is, because once you get on a roll with something, you know, you kind of get. You know, you get in the swing of it. You get, you know, you rediscover how you used to do everything, and it's just I just really enjoyed it, you know. And I fully expect at some point, maybe next winter, who knows, I'll do the same thing with freight cars at some point. Because I haven't really done a lot with freight cars for a long time, and that used to be all I did for a long period of time, you know. Meanwhile, I've got the ransom mill to build, which is all laid out on my table saw, and I haven't really touched that for, it's got to be a month and a half, and that might be the very first thing I get on when I finish up with locos, hopefully in the next week or two. So, you know, that'll get me back on to working on the layout, because I haven't really worked on the layout since I guess about the end of April or beginning of May after
since
I did that.
You started doing locomotives.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I did that huge binge to get Avoca Yard and the Kerr-McGee treatment tie treatment plant and the DuPont scene and all of that. So that might have been the most productive couple. That was like the early in the pandemic when nobody was doing anything and nobody was bothering me. And I had like 2 solid months to just immerse myself in layout construction with almost no distractions.
That's how I managed to do that state line redo, as I called it. Because if it hadn't been for the COVID thing keeping me home, 3 nights a week or whatever it was, I don't think I would have, that would still be undone.
Right. But yeah, you kind of jumped on that. It looked nice before you took it apart, but it looked way better when you got done. I mean, that's part of that's just advancing skill set, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It was a combination of one trouble spot where cars would derail every so often. And more than anything else, just always knowing from the beginning that when I get far enough along, and that's what happened, I went all the way around the basement and got everything scenic, quote unquote, I'm going to start over with some of my first locations and redo them. So I did that Fitzwilliam over.
Right.
And then I went to State Line because, it was scenic, but you know how it is. You just always look at it and say, I don't like how I did that. I think I could do better.
That's why I chuckle at the people who say, so what are you going to do when your layout's done? You know? Come on.
Start over.
You know, I like to get a scene presentable and then move on to a bare bones scene and get that presentable. And then if I got in the mood to super detail an area, I might go back to that area and do something. But, you know, I won't live long enough to run out of things to do on my layout, you know, and that's probably a good thing.
It is a good thing.
Well, it is anybody able to see anything on your layout online anywhere beyond the pictures that I will post?
I think that's a big negative.
Okay.
I think, unfortunately.
Until you start cranking out your articles.
Yeah. Well, right there was one.
Right at the top of the list.
Yes. Along with everything else. Ted Collider, here's an update for you. Well, first of all, Ted Collada came up and photographed my layout a few years ago, and that was in his volume 4 of Prototype Railroad Modeler, I think it's called.
Is that a magazine? Cover.
Yeah, it's a prototype magazine he puts out. In fact, I just got an email this morning. His number 5 just came out. In fact, I think it's only electronic as I'm speaking here, and he said the print one will go out in the mail shortly.
Can you email me a link for that, Jim? And I'll put it on the group as well, because I know people are going to want to see. In other words, the pictures I post will probably, really pique people's interest. So
I can do that. He still has some for sale. He just reprinted it, and I know he had some up for sale. And the other thing I'll mention is the last I knew, the next, 2021 Model Railroad Planning will have a feature in there on my layout if it goes according to plan.
Got it. And who knows exactly when that'll be?
It comes out in January typically.
Okay.
In fact, I think somebody sent me an email, and if you want to, he was on MR's or Kalmbach's website, and they even had a teaser for it and said B&M's Cheshire Branch.
So nice. So that's perfect. So that'll be the presented for posterity.
Hopefully not the last one, but
right.
Who knows what the future holds?
Right, but it'll be out there. Great talking with you, Jim. Something tells me that this won't be the only one that we do.
Well, that'd be great. I'm always available for you, Mike.
All right, folks. Well, until next time, take care.